And this is the podcast for Monday, January 23rd, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. So here we are in the third week. We have an exam which will open on Wednesday at 3:30. It will close the following Wednesday when the labs close here at 7 o'clock. Just a couple of reminders, all this information is in the syllabus. Also, if you click on the exam in Moodle, you'll also see these details, some of these details. So you have to arrive 1 hour before the lab closes on any given day. Other than that, you can take it anytime the lab is open. If you click on Computer Testing Lab in Moodle, you'll get all the lab hours. They have some limited Saturday hours and close Sunday. Don't forget they close early on Friday, so you can all the hours there. If you just click on the Computer Testing Lab link in Moodle, you'll see all of those. You are allowed a 3x5 card of notes, front and back. If you want that card back, put your name on it or put some identifying mark on it so you can identify it amongst all the other, the other 80 cards which will be collected. They will take that from you after you take your exam. It's not my policy, it's a testing lab policy. I guess some instructors don't like note cards being passed around among students. I wouldn't care, but it's a lab policy, and so it has to be uniform. So anyway, if you want those back after the test is closed, I'll bring them to the class here. You can pick them out. For the online students, you'll have to come by my office or make arrangements to pick them up. And I'll hold on to those to the end of the term, so if you want to just sort of grab them at the end of the term, that's fine too. Yeah?
I just want to know, since I live in Cottage Grove, do they have a testing center there? Can I take it there?
They do have a testing center in Cottage Grove. Yeah, you can take it there. They have different hours in the main campus. Their evening hours are actually a little better, I think.
Okay, great.
But I'd like contact them and let them know when you're coming. I'm not sure if they want an appointment, but you can talk to them about their hours because they change and they're sort of limited staff and smaller there. I think they only have a few stations there. I've actually taken tests there, and it's kind of nice because you're usually the only person there in the room, and so it's kind of quiet and no distractions.
Don't forget your ID.
Oh, yeah. So, and it doesn't have to be a lane ID. It doesn't have to be any picture ID, driver's license, or if you don't drive, one of those ID cards that the DMV will issue you, that you as a non-driver. All those are fine, or something sort of official, a passport. I don't think like your, sci-fi members of American Club is probably not good enough. So something that's a government document, picture ID. Okay, let's see, other things about the test. Multiple choice, true, false. Based on what we do in class here, based on the reading. I won't test specifically on any forum post, although sometimes in the forums I'll sort of give a really big hint or just, talk about something which will be on the exam. So you might want to look back through the post that I've made. Sometimes I'll be correcting other students, and you might see another student might say something like, well, Descartes says blah, 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 blah. What he means by that is blah, blah. And you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. And then you see me say, no, that's completely wrong. Here's the real answer. Sometimes I'll do this and correct students if they misinterpret something or misstate something. And that's really good because usually the things that the students will say that I'm correcting are common mistakes that people make about the concepts or the philosophers or the arguments and so on. Oh, shoot. It's really irritating. I wonder if there's a set. I have my other recorder. I've been using actually my laptop recordings. I'm doing some comparisons now. It's just easier to edit on my laptop. But this recorder has an annoying standby button where you have to press the button twice to start recording. So this shows that redundant systems are really good when you're doing something you don't want to have to do over again. Okay, other questions about the test?
Do you grade on the good old-fashioned curve?
Sort of. So what happens is I wait till everybody takes the exam, and then I look at, the number of people in the A range. And if I get like, you know, 15, 20% A, something like that, then I, or more, I figure, well, you know, those people figured it out. And particularly if I get, you know, people who've aced the exam, I figure, okay, that's probably fair. If I notice like the high score is like, you know, maybe like a 92 or something like that, I'm thinking, oh, this is, there's something hard there. Sometimes I'll look through for particular questions, and there's questions that I see, oh, almost nobody got that, and I look at it and I say, well, it was in the book, but I didn't really mention it in class, and it's kind of a hard question. So I might kick in, like, what I'll do is I'll add points to everyone's score. So two, usually I'll do it in even numbers. Sometimes I'll make it just like five, two, four, 5 points that I'll add to everyone's score. Sometimes, though, it's you know, nothing. So it just depends on, you know, how well people do. So that's the sort of curve part of it. Yeah.
I've never taken a test in the lab. Does it show you your grade right away, or do you have to wait?
So it'll show you your score right away.
Okay.
But it won't show you the answers. So for the answers, you'll have to come by the office. Or I'll say, if you got an A, and that means that you have missed no more than, let's see, 50%, but 5 questions, I can like give you a rundown of the ones you missed if you send me a Moodle message. If you didn't get an A, you know, this is without the curve, then I can't, like, if you got like a, you know, a B or a C, I can't tell you all 10 questions that you missed. But for those students that got an A, if you just missed, you know, 1, 2, or 3 questions, something like that, or maybe 4 up to 5 questions, send me a Moodle message and I'll tell you which ones you got wrong. Yeah.
I'm sure this is addressed in the syllabus, but how many questions are this person?
I think it's about 50.
50?
Sometimes I add a few in, 50 or 55, something around that. Also, I was going to say something else about the questions. If you want to review the test, if you didn't get an A, or if you did get an A, you just want to talk to me about the ones you missed, you can come by office hours and we can go over it on my big screen monitor and see which ones you missed, and we can discuss it. Yeah?
Is there a study guide online?
The study questions are actually integrated with the text, so there's 2 kinds of questions at the end of each section. One type is called questions for review. Those are the questions you should look at when reviewing for the exam. There's some other questions called questions for discussion, which have, although you can't really answer those unless you understand the questions for review, and those are sort of open-ended, so you don't need to know like the correct answer to those questions, but you need to understand the concept of those. But the questions for review are specifically to help you prepare for the test. Questions for discussion, those concepts will be on the test, but they won't ask you, like, what's the solution to the mind-body problem or something? Wrong class. What's the solution to, or, you know, which is a correct theory of knowledge? A, rationalism. B, empiricism. You know, C, neither a correct Kant's view is where it's at. D, Richard Rorty. E, phenomenology and all that crap they teach at the UOO. You know, I'm not going to give you like a list, you know, or F, Plato. We need to go back to Plato. Because, you know, there's not a consensus amongst philosophers. But you will be asked something like, you know, rationalism is the view that A, B, C, D, and you'll have to understand the definition of rationalism, definition of empiricism, the arguments for and against them. You know, I might give a question like, Descartes was A, a rationalist, B, an empiricist, you know, C, something else, and that sort of thing. So it'll be based on, again, the basic concepts and definitions, the particular philosophers. So if you have a hard time connecting names with views, you might want to make some flashcards or something. So you should know, like, automatically, if I say Descartes, you should think rationalism. If I say Plato, you should think rationalism. If I say Locke, you should think empiricism. And so those are like basic, you know, questions. Those are the easy questions that, you know, just coming to class and reading the book, I expect you to know John Locke, empiricist. René Descartes, rationalist. Plato, rationalist. Even though Plato's not in the book, we talked about him in class. And that goes to sort of the idea. And actually, I think on the test, I might have a few more questions that I've added in. So there might be, let's say there might be up to 60 questions on the exam by Wednesday. There's with the Plato stuff, like the allegory of the cave, you know, that's not highlighted in the text, but something I showed the video in class. We talked about it, so that's something that you should know for the test. Yes.
And so, which chapter? Is it chapter 1 through 3?
Oh, good question. So, the exam will cover all of chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 3 only through Locke.
Only through Locke, right?
Chapter 3 empiricism is a big chapter, and the empiricists, we're doing a lot with them. So it's going to be chapters 1 and 2, chapter 3 through Locke. So that's the stuff about direct realism and representationalism, and the essay on human understanding, which we'll be talking about this week. But no Barclay on this exam, no Keenan, so only through Locke, chapter 3. And then all the stuff about the correspondence theory of truth and all that stuff in chapter 1. So the truth and knowledge, Descartes and Locke will be the three things we're talking about. Again, plus anything we've done in class is fair game. Okay, any other questions about the exam? Okay-do. Well, let's... we didn't talk much about these arguments for God's existence from Descartes. Let's start with this. So what do you think about these? So we take any one to begin with. The... we'll start with the ontological argument. Maybe not. I'm thinking, take these in order. So what's the first one is let's see if this is the right way. How could an imperfect and finite human being come up with the idea of an infinite and perfect God? So let's put it that way, form the question. So Descartes asks, how could an imperfect and finite, I'll put humanity here, come up with the concept of an infinite and perfect being. And that's sort of part of the definition of God that Descartes is working with, is this kind of classical conception of God as this infinite and perfect being. And so God's omnipotent, he's omniscient, which means he has all knowledge. So omnipotent means all powerful. Omniscient means all-knowing. Omnibenevolent.
Omnipresent.
Yeah, the omnipresent thing, I guess, that's kind of a tricky concept. And that's sometimes that's sort of not on the list, because philosophers don't really have a hard time saying that God is everywhere, what exactly that means. He sort of pervades the universe, or and people confuse that too with the sort of Hindu concept that God is everything, instead of the idea that God is in everything. But let's, omnibenevolent means he's perfectly good, or all good. And then eternal means that he's, been around forever. He doesn't have any beginning or end. What's that?
Lives forever.
That's part of being eternal. I suppose immortal. And these are all sort of... So God's been around forever. He will be around forever. He can't be killed. And he doesn't die. And there's one more... what was I missing here? Oh, spiritual. So he's going to say immaterial or spiritual. Immaterial. And then that God is sort of God's a kind of
conscious being. I'll put the word personal here. So Descartes working with the sort of classical Western concept of God as a personal being, as opposed to the Eastern concept where God is seen as more of an impersonal force or principle. So God is a personal being. God has a mind, will, and emotions. God makes decisions. He has a will. He has desires and so on. As opposed to like gravity, right? Gravity doesn't shed a tear when Mother Teresa falls off a cliff, right? You know, the radar doesn't panic when the missile finally comes from North Korea or Iran heading towards New York City. And so you know, inanimate, or not inanimate, but there's unconscious forces. The Eastern concept is sort of that God, in its essence, it really isn't a being like us in the sense that it has a mind. It's just sort of like a part of unconscious nature. At least that's one of the dominant schools in Eastern philosophy. But in the West, God is seen as a person, as a mind, just a disembodied, I suppose. This gets kind of tricky when it comes to Christianity. I'll just put with qualifiers. You know, before, if you're a Christian, before the incarnation of Jesus, God was an infinite disembodied mind, and then one of the persons of the Trinity took on human flesh. But you might say that God, in his original essence or nature, is a disembodied mind. So human souls are sort of the finite version of the finite, flawed version of God, except for we're embodied. We're stuck in a body. But you could think about the concept of God as being sort of like an infinite soul or something like that. So this is what he says is the concept of God. And you know, talk to people, you're like, is there a God? And what do you mean by God? Oh, you know, he's sort of, he's like the ultimate being. He created everything. He knows all and sees all. And he lives forever and rules from heaven. And he created the world and everything in it. And that's kind of the intuitive concept you have of God. And you go way back to the ancient Greeks, and people had that sort of idea of God. And it's a fairly commonplace idea. And so Descartes says, well, where do we get this idea of a God from? And he thinks that it's what? He has a term for ideas like God. Where does Descartes think the idea of God came from?
Doesn't he?
Yeah, it came from God, right? I think Locke might say the idea of God came from God too, but then how did it come from God?
So it's in there, it's planted in everyone, that the idea from birth was...
Yeah, so it's called an innate idea. Innate idea is a really important concept in Descartes. He would say things like God, morality, and then things like math. And maybe sort of basic conceptual knowledge. Math and logic. So all these are innate ideas, and he thinks God is one of his innate ideas too. And his argument is as follows. Well, look, the concept of God is of this perfect infinite being. So how could you ever gotten this concept by just kind of looking around the world around you? You can't see God. You can't hear God. So you're sort of looking around. Can you look around the world and sort of figure out that there's a God? He thinks that the only reason this idea is so widespread is that God planted this innate idea, and it's sort of like 2 and 2 equals 4. And people will say, well, of course there's a God, because where did the world come from? That's sort of part of our basic logical conceptual knowledge, that there must be a God, and that God is sort of this ultimate being. And he says, how could an imperfect and finite human being come up with the concept of an infinite God, of a perfect God? How can the perfect conceive the imperfect? How can the finite conceive of the infinite?
therefore God must have given this idea, given us this idea himself, and planted it in our minds from birth. So what do you think about that argument? Yes, sir.
I think God is a great way to backstop the difference between nothing and everything.
Hmm. Sounds very Buddhist.
Well, it gives a measure. It gives the ability to conceptualize the things that stand between nothing and everything. God is the everything part of the quotient.
When you say stands between, what do you mean?
I mean that in order to measure a thing, you have to have a scale. Uh-huh. That scale has to be between, if you're measuring in inches, it has to be between 0 inches, something that has no space, and an infinite number of inches, jillions upon jillions of miles in space. In order to conceptualize something that's 6 inches long, you have to understand how long can be. Hmm. Therefore, God becomes innate.
So nothing and everything. So are you talking about being able to explain things? Is that what you're talking about? Conceptualize things?
And then thereafter, being able to explain things.
So this would be like knowing nothing? Like between ignorance and enlightenment? I'm just trying to see, okay, so it's sort of God sort of fills in the knowledge of our gaps in understanding or something like that.
One which realizes that they don't know everything because they're constantly learning something would have a tendency to conceptualize somebody who knows everything. You're running into people who know more than you on a regular basis. I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. You can just extrapolate beyond that there's somebody who knows everything. It is all time. You know nothing and are limited.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. Like one might be, this is sort of sometimes people call God sort of the God of the gaps. And this is the idea that the concept of God emerged when human beings didn't have science. And so when they found something they couldn't understand, they said, oh, God must have done it. Where did the world come from? Well, this God must have done it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, building on that, God could have just came out of like a scapegoat. And what I mean by that is, you know, don't quote me on this, but the way that I see it is that earlier tribes and stuff like that, you always have some kind of leader and stuff like that. And I don't exactly know how their system worked as far as who would be the head of whatever, you know, their tribe would be. And, you know, maybe after a while, certain things didn't start going right. Well, you have to blame somebody, right? And so, well, the gods didn't want, or, you know, whatever, this exterior force didn't want us to do, or, you know, the crops are crappy this year. And so, the gods of the rain, weren't shining down on us or whatever the case may be. And so the concept of, you know, different gods for different things. And then after a while, it evolved to just one instead of all these many other gods, I guess. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So it's not like, you know, the guy who was supposed to, like, sow the grain at a certain time that was, like, slacking off and didn't do it because he's, you know, off drunk someplace, right? It wasn't his fault. He's like, the forces of nature are angry with us because of our, we have turned from their worship or something.
Right.
Yeah, well, sure. So, God is scapegoat. And, you know, it's useful for political leaders too, right? Scapegoat. And maybe as, justification for power. You say, well, you follow me because I'm in touch with the gods that make the crops grow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I would say, how could we not come up with such a concept? It seems to me that the imperfect beings are the ones who spend the most time dreaming of perfection.
And that's a sort of idea that it could be just
this concept of abstraction that the empiricists really like. So with abstraction, you go from the not finite to the infinite. And Descartes actually says,
we don't really have a concept of infinity, we have a concept of not finiteness. It's not a positive comment. It's not, the infinity isn't a positive comment, a concept. Because you look at just even the derivation of the word infinite, the in means not. Like if something's invalid, right, it means not valid. So infinite means not finite. And if you think about it, you really have a positive concept of infinity. No, infinity is just the idea of no limits. And so we have a concept of negation, right? And we have a concept of limitations that we steal around us, right? You try to do a thing and you can't do it. Oh, that's my, you know, as Clint Eastwood says in Magnum Force, man's got to know his limitations. Right, that's his tagline phrase in that movie. Right, so you try to do things and you can't do them. You have limitations in your knowledge, powers, and abilities, and you say, okay, that's I'm finite. I have all these limits, but you can sort of imagine in your mind this concept of you or somebody else without those limits, and even without the limitation of a body, and without the limitation of being mortal. You go from mortal to immortal, from limited power and no power to all power. You just sort of kind of abstract in your mind, you can come up with this concept, it seems, just by like closing your eyes and thinking about concepts. Yeah?
Just for
those. Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to steal your thunder. Somebody else. Yeah?
Just out of curiosity, was Descartes a heliocentrist or a geocentrist? You know?
Descartes was actually Descartes was a heliocentrist and actually almost perhaps scuttled his career as a philosopher with a book on astronomy, where he'd read Copernicus and thought Copernicus was right, and he actually wrote a book on astronomy called The World, where he defended Galileo and Copernicus. He took it to the publisher, dropped it off, went home, spent a sleepless night worrying about it, ran to the publisher the next day saying, no, I've changed my mind, don't print my book. Because he's afraid that what was going to happen to him would be what happened to Galileo, which was, you know, he's threatened with torture and forced to recant. Yeah.
And the other question I had was, when he's talking about humanity, is he only speaking of Europe and like doing Greek and Romans, or is he speaking of Asia and India?
He's speaking of everybody. He would say that everyone has this concept of the sort of infinite being. And they might disagree on some of the details. Descartes isn't, you know, really aware of, you know, indigenous customs and tribes. Although, I mean, he was well-read, so I think, and he knew, like, the classical Greeks and Romans and about them. I think what Descartes might say about them, though, is that, well, they're kind of morally corrupt, and so they sort of, he might have quoted the Book of Romans because he's a Catholic, that they traded the image of the incorruptible God for the forms of men and reptiles and birds, and sort of. So he might say, even the Greeks and Romans had this idea of this all-powerful God, but because of their moral corruption, they sort of sublimated it. In the same way that you can know something's true and you can kind of repress it and push it down and not be aware, consciously aware of it, or try or deny it, even though deep down in your heart you know it's true. Other thoughts on Descartes' argument? How could a finite and imperfect being come up with this such a grandiose concept of this creator of the world unless there was such a being? This is argument. Yeah.
Could you say that God came from death? The idea that death helped create the idea that we could be, or there is maybe some infinite being, because like Neanderthals, when they buried their dead, they buried things with their dead, which may mm-hmm. have suggested that they had a spiritual idea of, you know, maybe of God, even them, you know.
That's a good question. There's actually, so this,
X, or, death.
There's an interesting book called The God Part of the Brain. It's by a science journalist named Matthew Alpert. And his idea is that people have, when people realize their own mortality, when we got to the point where you're able to, human beings are unique in being able to recognize that they will die someday. And so his idea is that this is going to create a lot of stress and anxiety. And it's going to, and stress and anxiety and fear can be paralyzing. And so as human beings evolved, those who were able to sort of deal with that fear in the, and cope with it were able to survive, and that's what how you know, belief in afterlife sort of came about, and that it pushes down the anxiety and fear, which will keep you from, say, fighting off a man-eating animal or you know, fighting an enemy tribe, right? You know, well, my body may die, but my soul is going to go to the afterlife, and I'm going to get heavenly reward if I fight in this battle. And then, if enough of the tribe have that sort of belief, then they're going to survive and the other tribes are going to get wiped out. Yeah, so that's another explanation. There are all sorts of explanations for where the concept of God came from. Yeah?
Yeah, one more. Maybe to explain the imperfections of us by making something so perfect. I mean, like, human existence is definitely far from perfect, and there's a lot of ugly things in the human comedy or experience, whatever you want to call it, and creating an all-perfect amazing God is an easy way to explain existence,
It seems though that, you know, if I was going to explain like why life's so terrible, like the idea that there's a loving heavenly father who has our best interest in heart wouldn't be like my first shot at it. I mean, maybe the devil or something like that. Yeah. Might say that's where the concept of the devil came from. But you might, I mean, generally, this idea that we need God to explain things, is God sort of a placeholder for things that human beings have figured out? Like the weather patterns, for example, right? So the Greeks used to think that, thunderstorms, sort of scary, as Zeus throwing down thunderbolts from Mount Olympus. And because he was angry. And people thought that storms existed because the gods were angry at human beings. And this idea of personifying the forces of nature is something anthropologists say are like the beginnings of religion. And you can look at, like, say, troops of gorillas, and they'll actually beat their chests when there's a big thunderstorm, right? So there's, you know, the thunder and lightning, and the gorillas will like look up in the sky and they'll beat their chests in a kind of a threat gesture, saying, "I'm not afraid of you, Noah." And it reminds me of, like, I used to have this dog, and the evil garbage truck would come around, you know, every Wednesday, and would like kind of go along the fence line, and my dog would like, you know, whimper to go out, bolt towards the fence, and then follow the garbage truck along the fence, barking like crazy. And it, every time, sure enough, it worked, and the evil garbage truck went away. Right, until next week. But my dog thought that he was scaring away the evil garbage truck, which is sort of this big, loud, scary noise that he didn't know what it was, but whatever it wasn't good, and he was going to scare it away by, you know, barking really loud. And so the idea is that the original religious rituals and ceremonies were meant to scare away the evil spirits. So what do you do? You can still see forms of this, you know, today in the jungles amongst the Aboriginal tribes, places like Haiti, Sub-Saharan Africa. So what does like the shaman do? He's sort of practicing Stone Age religion. Well, he puts on a really scary mask, and then he gets like a rattle or a drum and bangs it really loud and says, you know, and then he utters like magical words which are supposed to force the spirit to leave. And this sort of idea of manipulating the forces of nature, these sort of unseen spiritual forces, are where the beginnings of religion, according to some theories.
Another alternative sort of evolution.
I'm trying to remember if I have a much of a section on this in the text. Did I talk about the evolution of religion in the text? Yes, no, maybe?
Yes.
Going from like animism to to polytheism to finally the sort of abstract monotheism of Descartes. And it's sort of an evolution. Today, I mean, it's kind of, you have this weird kind of neo-primitivism movement. No offense to any of you neo-pagans out there in the class, but there's even a sort of this, I guess, the noble savages back, and people, they think that the best life is like, you know, to go back to living in grass huts. And they're like reading all about how great it is to live in a grass hut in the jungle on their iPhone. And I just, it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, actually, it does make sense. I think it's kind of a weird malady we get when you get really comfortable, things become really easy. But on the other hand, it's psychologically, it's stressful. You have your iPhone, your BlackBerry going off every minute. And you have all these things you have to manage in your life. And you're thinking, oh, wouldn't it be simpler to just live close to nature, to throw my iPhone in the trash, and to, you know, gather roots and berries. Yeah. But I think once you get down there and, you know, maybe you get the jungle fever or... you know, get bit by a poisonous snake, and pretty soon you're like, "Where's the nearest hospital?" Yeah, you get maybe a toothache or something, and you're screwed because it's like, okay, well, what am I gonna do now? It hurts so bad. I guess I'll just have to take this piece of twine and wrap it around my tooth, and yank it out. You know, it's just you're back to. Stone Age medical treatment, and pretty soon that hectic life back in the States doesn't seem so bad. So, but you have this evolution of the concept of God, and you take an anthropology class, they'll talk about, you know, animal totems and people that worship the ancestors in the Stone Age, and then moving to this sort of magic and voodoo, and then moving to this intermediate stage of a hierarchy of gods, with the king of the gods that sort of mimics the aristocracy that you have in human civilization. And so, you know, Stone Age religion is, so you have this sort of tribal gods, who's the god of the tribe and local geographic area. You get to the higher civilization, and you have a kind of a aristocratic concept of gods with a kind of nobility with a king of the gods and various stratifications of underlings. They call that a pantheon, right? Like the Olympian pantheon, you get Zeus, and then under him you have like the major gods, like the god of war and the god of love, and then you got gods that are sort of limited, like the god of blacksmiths, and then you still have those ancestral gods down there at the bottom and minor spirits and so on. And then finally, you get this idea of spiritual one-stop shopping in monotheism, where there's this idea that there's just one god, and he does everything. And as the concept of God sort of evolves, God becomes more and more abstract and less, you know, human-like, and, you know, doesn't have a body. And because you look at, you know, Zeus, he's like a human being. He goes around having adulterous affairs. He squabbles with his wife. He has problems managing his nobility. You know, he has these very, very human-like quality. But even in ancient Greek mythology, you can see, like, even amongst the Greek plays, you can see gods. Zeus sort of morphs from this kind of, very human-like king to the personification of justice. And this sort of evolves even in Greek society. Anyway, so the long and short of it is that the god that's around in, say, Descartes' time is, you know, the result of a long process of development of a concept. And so you wonder, like, you know, what do you think he would say? Like, what about... to the guys, you find the Stone Age tribes in Brazil, and you ask them, well, you know, what do you believe in? And they don't say, oh, well, we believe in, you know, one God, omnipotent, omniscient, you know, and the creator of the world and everything in it, and so on. Well, where's their innate idea? So what do you think he would have a rebuttal, or what might he say?
The Stone Age Brazilian culture?
What's that?
The Stone Age Brazilian
culture.
Numerous gods, god of tribe, god of the brain, god of whatever, a pagan type situation?
Yeah, Descartes says that the aboriginal, like that guy, he was living in the rainforest of Brazil, and they found these tribes like in the 50s, 40s or 50s, they found these tribes that had been isolated for, like, you know, they've been absolutely isolated. They're like in the interiors of the rainforest, or what they used to call the jungle, right? for tens of thousands of years, to essentially living the way human beings did 50,000 years ago, as hunter-gatherers. But why aren't they saying, oh, God is a being who's you know, omnipotent and omniscient and so on? They're worshiping animal totems and the spirits of their ancestors. Yeah.
Well, then you also have the cargo cults of World War II who worship us. Who worship our planes and the cargo that we dropped off for them. Does that mean that they thought we, our military, is omniscient and omnipotent? Or what idea they have of us as gods?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, I mean, that's more like, again, this really primitive idea, this sort of magical idea of the cargo cults. I'm not sure. I've done a long study of the cargo cults, but I'm not sure that necessarily they thought the missionaries of gods, but they thought they had some secret magical knowledge for bringing gifts to the gods, and if they could just figure out, sort of crack the code of the magical ritual, they could do the same thing. But yeah, so. Again, if you ask the people at the cargo cults, who do you worship? They're like, oh, we got this god and that god and the other god, and we worship the ancestors. And there are all these different spirits. And sometimes there's like a high god who's a creator, but it's not. There's no idea that he's the only god. And even then, their gods tend to have like human characteristics. Yeah. Oh, did you have your hand up?
No.
Oh, sorry. So, I mean, that can be kind of difficult, yeah.
I mean, their societies themselves haven't really evolved yet, they're hunter-gatherer. I've done some reading about religion evolving through agriculture, where it's hunter-gathering and symbols, and then agriculture changes it more of a powerful structure,
mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth, as you said, like evolution of God or society. So, I mean, like, they kind of start out, as you said, very paganistic, tribal worship. And then through time, they have more conceptual ideas maybe through education.
Well, now, Descartes might say, if you educated them and said, well, look, here, like, have you ever thought about where the world came from? And it doesn't seem really weird that, you know, your God who created the world would, like, make mistakes. And he might say, if you ask them enough questions, they might realize that their beliefs are wrong, if they were going to be rational, they would say, oh, of course, now I realize there's just one God. And he thinks that they have this innate idea, it's just that it hasn't been expressed yet, you might say. It's the same way, have you ever had like two beliefs and you realize that they're contradictory later on? You're like, you just like never made the connection between the two, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, if I believe this, like, for example, there's this talk show host, Mark Levin. And he's going along about personal liberties and how the government tells you that you get what kind of light bulb you have to use and whether you can smoke a cigarette and whether you can have salt in your food, and they're trying to regulate portion size and all these different things. And he's like, no, you know, you have absolute right. You have liberty about what you put in your own body. But when it comes to like smoking marijuana, he's like, oh no, you know, the federal government should throw you in prison if you smoke a joint. And to me, that's like a contradictory view. And I'm like, you have a right to put in what you want in your own body, or you don't. And so if you're going to be rational and someone says, look, you think that you don't want the government telling you what you can eat, what you can drink, and whether you can smoke tobacco, but you think it's perfectly okay for them to tell you can't smoke marijuana, right? And then it's sort of, you go back and forth and you think, okay, that's a... And you don't have to think smoking marijuana is good. You might think that it's the devil weed, right? I mean, you might think that it's really harmful, but, you know, no more harmful than alcohol. And alcohol's not legal. I mean, not illegal anymore. So, So there's an inconsistency, and so you think either you either have to say, okay, well, I don't really think that, I think the government under certain circumstances can tell you what to do with regard to your own health and your own body, or you have to say, no, I was totally wrong, marijuana should be legalized. But you got to go one way or the other. And Descartes would say, in the same way you do that rational process where you're rooting out inconsistencies, you could do the same thing with religion. When someone suggests, well, this religious view doesn't really make any sense, if you have all these different gods squabbling with each other, could these beings have created the world? Would they really, I think he would say that once you get the person reflecting on the concept of God, they'd realize there could only be one. That would be his argument, probably. And that he would have to be a perfect being to have created the world. And he'd have to have, immense power. Maybe not omnipotent, but he'd have to be super powerful. He wouldn't be the sort of penny ante animal totem or spirit or something. But then you cast some counter-arguments back and forth, right? That, could a perfect and infinite God have created this world? And that's a whole other can of worms. Anyway, so these are some arguments. That one more is a sort of projection of a father figure. Of Floyd. And this is the kind of idea that you grew up, you look at your father as God when you're like so high, right? When you're really, really young, your father is a sort of the provider, and later on you grow up, this sort of gets stuck in your unconscious mind, this image of your father as the provider, and then you realize your father has feet of clay, that he makes mistakes, that he's a flawed human being, but you have the psychological need to be loved and taken care of, and also to be given a set of rules to follow, so you'll have certainty. And so Freud hypothesized that your unconscious mind creates this father figure, your heavenly father, to take care of you. So there are all sorts of counter-arguments or alternative explanations to how this idea of God got into our minds, any of which seems to be at least as good as this idea as an innate idea. And it seems there are a lot of people with innate ideas who are supposed to have innate ideas that don't have them, like your aboriginals or, I suppose, your atheists. I run into people who said, I never really did believe in this God thing even when I was so high. It just never made sense to me. So then the question is, where's that person's innate idea of God? It's not like you run into people that say, I never did get this 2 + 2 = 4 thing. I always rejected mathematics as being real, and so on. So, another argument, because I want to get to Locke today. The other argument, the main argument, I think, is the ontological argument. So God is a perfect being, existence is a perfection, which means it's a quality which makes you more perfect than if you didn't have it. Therefore, God exists. And then maybe there's another step here. A perfect being must contain all perfections. This is just unpacking the definition of what it means to be a perfect being. So God is a perfect being. A perfect being must contain all perfections. Otherwise he wouldn't be perfect, right? He'd be missing something. Existence is a perfection. Therefore, God must exist. So this is Descartes' version of the ontological argument. It's the argument from being. It comes from the Greek word ontos, which means being.
So he's saying this in a finite physical manner.
Not sure what you mean by that.
Therefore, God must exist. He's saying that God actually exists.
Right, God exists in reality. And so
not
it's just
really human, but I mean, is a reality-based.
Right, that God exists, you know, independently of human thought, not just as a concept. Yes.
So how would you explain all the imperfections in, you know, say, cancers and children born with birth defects? If God's perfect, then that's part of His will. I mean,
I think
suffering, you know.
That's a good question. That might be one objection.
He's over here. One objection might be the problem of evil.
Now, I think Descartes might say, well, God gave human beings the gift of free will, and human beings misused that, and it's led to all the problems we're having now. It's a sort of traditional Christian answer. Yeah.
Isn't that a tautology?
A what?
Tautology.
A tautology? No, it's a deductive argument. So a tautology is something like, I know what.
Tautology formally is, you know, A equals A. A is equal to A, actually.
Isn't that the same thing?
No, this is a deductively valid argument. But it's not. But it's deductively valid, but I don't think it's a sound, deductively sound argument. But if it's true that that God is a perfect being, if it's true that a perfect being must contain all perfections, and if it's true that existence is a perfection, then it follows necessarily that God exists. So logically, if the premises are true, this is the definition of a deductively valid argument. If the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. So tell me how the premises could be true and the conclusion not be true. Put it that way. Right. Now the question is, are these premises true? So you might question, like, some of these premises are true. So then in this case, so it's this is a valid argument. There's no errors in logic, but you might question whether the premises are true. So it's a question about whether it's sound. It's just kind of a difference. Sometimes people use the word cogent or sound. So, but valid just has to do with the logical structure of the argument.
And so going into it, the statement is that God is a perfect being, correct? And so
right.
From that statement, you're going into God exists.
Yeah,
from
so...
A to B.
So just from the concept of God, if you think about... Descartes' idea is this way. If you think about the concept of God long enough, you'll see that He has to exist. And this is part of the rationalist method. Right? Think about to the dream argument, right? Descartes says, well, how do I know I even exist? Well, if I'm wondering whether I exist, I must exist in order to wonder whether I exist. So the very fact that I'm wondering about it proves that I exist as a wondering or a thinking thing. And so this is the same sort of deductive argument. He says, okay, well, what is this concept of God that everybody has? Well, God's this perfect being. Well, what does it mean to be perfect? Okay, think about the concept of perfection. Well, a perfect being would have to have all the properties which would make it, you know, perfect. Every perfect making quality. If it's lacking something or missing something, it's not perfect. Part of the concept of perfection is being complete. And so if God was lacking some, if the concept of God is lacking some property, or if God was lacking some property which would make him better, then he wouldn't really be God, or he wouldn't be a perfect being. So the idea is that God, everyone understands God's a perfect being. Perfect means you have to have all the perfect making qualities. Well, isn't it more perfect to exist than not to exist? You know, and you would say yes, and so therefore, you know, God exists in reality. And it's again just thinking about the concept of God. And he thinks that cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, that sort of reasoning can also prove God's existence. If you think if God is really perfect, then he has to exist. If he doesn't exist, he's not perfect. But you've just agreed that God is a perfect being, so he has to exist. Not existing is a pretty big flaw, right?
No, but just barely existing is not. That's far cry from total perfection.
What do you mean by barely existing?
Well, you said that just isn't existence perfect enough, you know. Isn't just existing perfection, but...
It doesn't mean that everything that exists is perfect. It means that the property of existence is a perfect making quality. That if you have for any given thing, it's more perfect for it to exist than not to exist. It just doesn't mean, but it doesn't mean like if this pen exists, it's perfect. But it means if I have if I compare this actual existing pen with a imaginary pen, the existing pen is more perfect than the imaginary. This kind of goes back to Plato with this sort of gradation of existence, right? Where you have the truly real world and then like the shadows. And the shadows aren't really as real as the actual objects which cast the shadows. In the same way, he thinks that that God, if God was just a shadow, he would be, you know, perfect. But the real object is, the real is the perfect, is this sort of argument. Yeah.
Then how could God be all-powerful and give us free will at the same time? Because wouldn't him being all-powerful take away our free will? Wouldn't that be a big part of
Well, all-powerful just means that God has the ability to exercise all power. It doesn't mean that he has to. So it just means that God can do anything, but it doesn't mean that God does do everything. So I think that's what he would say. So God could have made human beings without free will, but he decided to make us with free will and to not exercise his power in certain circumstances. Yeah.
But then again, isn't he also, if he was all-loving and then all-powerful, wouldn't he do everything within his power to make sure that all of his creations are happy?
And not suffering?
Yeah.
Happiness is...
That's a good question.
That's true.
Well, it's a good question. Is happiness the most important value, you might say? I mean, some people would say happiness is good, but is it the only thing that's good? And there might be certain things that are logically incompatible with happiness. And one of them might be freedom, right? Freedom has to mean, you know, logically, freedom to fail. Failing is painful, and it makes you upset because you wanted something that you weren't able to get it because you screwed up. Why did you screw up? Well, God let you screw up. Why did he let you screw up? Because he thinks it's better for you to be free and make mistakes than to be sort of, you know, be in a condition where you can't make mistakes. Yeah.
But the problem lies in the claim of omnibenevolence, because that doesn't go along with omniscience and omnipotence, because an all-knowing, all-powerful God would create free will knowing everything that humanity would ever do. And he cannot benevolently know that all of these horrible things are going to happen to all of these people. That means that he knows what's going to happen, he has the ability to do all that, but he's not benevolent enough to prevent that. Regardless of what would happen, it's also taking all the bad things
that happen. Okay, so now we're getting into the details of the problem of evil, right? Let's just get two more people on that and we'll move on. Yeah.
That presupposes that God doesn't know what is good and bad. Sometimes things that are unpleasant, he just misses.
Yeah.
How would you know what good was if it was not evil? You would understand the fact of you doing things. You wouldn't understand that there was a capability of doing something wrong. So bad would not exist.
If your kid's born with their brain,
okay, I said just two. I said just two more, so I want to move on to something else here. Sorry to cut the discussion short, but I do want to talk a little bit about Locke today. So, anyway, you can see some of the problems with the ontological argument. I mean, the problem of evil is a problem in itself. There's also this question about, you know, existence as a property. You know, is existence a property? And what does it really mean? It seems sort of... the concept of perfection is kind of sort of vague. What do you mean by more perfect and less perfect? It's sort of vague. And there's a sort of idea of degrees of reality in the Platonic metaphysics, which seems kind of iffy.
What do you mean on the existence property?
Well, if I say, like, you know, if I give a list of the properties of, like, say, this mug, right? I say, well, it's made out of plastic, and it's purple, and it holds 16 ounces, and so on, to give all the properties. Like, one of the things that doesn't seem to be one of the list of properties, I'd say, well, and it exists. It seems like the thing and its properties either exist or they don't. Existence isn't a property in the same way of being cylindrical or 16 ounce or, you know. It's existence is something which applies to things with certain properties or it doesn't. So, to use an example, so to say something exists means that an object with certain properties is exemplified in the real world. That there is an actual thing out there in the world to which this concept applies. So you can't smuggle existence into the list of properties of an object and define it into existence.
Is it a state then?
It's not really a state because a state is a quality. Existence is something which either applies to an object of a certain description or doesn't. So I could say, like, Sherlock Holmes, right? Fictional characters can kind of be kind of iffy, but just take Sherlock Holmes, you know, wears a funny beanie cap, is super smart, and, you know, lived in England in the 19th century, right? So I would say Sherlock Holmes doesn't exist. But if I was talking about Sherlock Holmes, I wouldn't say, oh, you know, he's, you know, wears a beanie cap, is... lived in 221 Baker Street, and then I would say, you know, doesn't exist as a property, because that doesn't exist applies to Sherlock Holmes himself, who's defined by his properties. It's not a property itself, like wearing a beanie cap or being really smart or being a British citizen, and so on. I don't even say categories, they're different concepts. The concept of existence and the concept of property are different. And this gets into, like, really, you know, complicated metaphysical stuff. Just to remember for now, most philosophers are dubious about existence being a property. In the same way as being, you know, square or brown or really old or something like that would be a property. And we'll get into properties and qualities with when we get to Locke, maybe a little bit more clear. So, Most philosophers are skeptical about whether Descartes can really, you know, establish God's existence with these arguments. And the ontological argument and the origin of the idea of a God argument, you know, are fraught with difficulties. So, but let's just imagine that we did get these through. So Descartes wants to go from... I exist to God exists, and then what's his third step? Well, God exists and is no deceiver, is what he'll say. And then he tries to explain deception, and that's where the free will thing comes in. And then finally concludes knowledge is possible. And his theory of knowledge, you know, rests on this foundation that God exists. And his idea is as follows. If you think about God, again, the deductive reasoning, unpacking concepts, what is God? God is this perfect being. Well, would a perfect being try to fool you? Would a perfect being create a world where you would make mistakes all the time when you tried your, pardon me, level best? So in other words, would a benevolent creator, pardon me, design flaw.
For me too.
Yeah, that works. My throat gets really dried out. I've also had a massive throat infection that's sort of been dogging me. So, But as a result of free will, no doubt. I got some good antibiotics to knock it out. But I think of that when the blower is going here and I'm talking for a long time, my throat gets dried out. So, let's see, where was I? Would a benevolent God create a world where if we tried our level best, we could never get knowledge? And Descartes says, no, that would be like the arch deceiver. Or that would be, you know, a God who is sort of cruel, who would make it impossible for you to know anything. And he says, if God really is perfect, then he's good. And you think about people that are sort of evil and malevolent, they usually have some psychological problem, right? They were locked in the closet when they were a kid, or their dad died from facing cocaine in front of them in the living room when they were four, or they were beaten or taunted or whatever. You look at people who you find in the jail for like murder and rape, like that Bandersloot guy, and there's something off with them, maybe something wrong with their brain. And so, you know, moral imperfection is a form of imperfection. And so if God is morally perfect, then he could not allow human beings to go wrong all the time when they try their best to get knowledge. So Descartes says, therefore, God must have created the world so that we are capable of knowledge. And then he says, well, why do people make mistakes? Well, you know, free will. And there's a whole section there where he says, look, sometimes people make mistakes, but that's their own damn fault, right? And usually he says what happens in mistakes, people believe something without sufficient evidence, that they give their assent or their intellectual agreement with something without having absolute proof. And he says, as long as you stick with what's clear and distinct logical arguments, and don't give your agreement unless you're 100% certain that the conclusion follows from the premises and the premises are true, then you're going to make a mistake. Did I say that right? That was a long sentence. Unless, he would say that if you don't have 100%, if you don't insist on 100% certainty before agreeing with an idea, then you're going to make a mistake and you'll be wrong. But if you stick with only what's clear and distinct and only what follows from intuitively true premises, and you follow chains of deductive arguments, you're going to come up with true beliefs. Yeah.
Wouldn't that also argue that the mistake, when you realize that you have a false belief, would also help you arrive to a new knowledge or the possible truth, the free will allow that to happen?
Uh-huh.
Your mistakes are really more like the God's way of giving you your knowledge.
Yeah, maybe you could learn through trial and error, sure. Mm-hmm. That's more of a kind of empiricist thing. Although you think what Descartes would say, you know, you make a mistake and you try something else. But you need to be aware and to be really conscientious about trying to get to the truth. So that's sort of Descartes' overall theory of knowledge, going from proving his own existence in meditation to proving God's existence, to proving God's goodness, and then using that as a sort of guarantee of all other knowledge. That if there is a God and he's good, he must have set up the world so that we could get knowledge of it if we tried our best in using our gift of free will and don't give our assent to any proposition which we're not absolutely certain about. And a couple of things about Descartes, the rationalist idea. He follows this intuition and deduction method, right? So there are certain things you know just by thinking about them, and those, he says, are known through intuition. Those are things you just see are true in one step, like 2 and 2 is 4. And then there's these deductions where you chain up several of the intuitions together, like in his argument for God here, in I Think Therefore I Am, you chain together several intuitions and with intuitively known rules and get a conclusion. In the same way you do geometry or math, right? You start out with the axioms, which are self-evident, and then you use self-evident forms of reasoning to deduce further truths. And that's his model for knowledge. And again, that's part and parcel of the rationalist theory of knowledge, where you can just sort of close your eyes and think about concepts and deduce all the juice of philosophy. And as we'll see with Locke, you know, the empiricists say, no, it's not like that at all. You need to use your senses. That reason can play some role, but the senses have to play a major role in the foundation of knowledge. And you can't do philosophy on a purely deductive model, but you have to use induction. You have to gather evidence of the senses and then use your mind to sort of put it together in the right way. Well, I don't think we had time to get to Locke today, so we'll start with Locke right out of the gate on Wednesday. Yeah.
So the test will cover not up to Locke, but through Locke.
Through Locke, yeah.
Through Locke.
So on Wednesday it will be all Locke and then some review, probably the last 15 minutes of class.
Thank you.
Yeah.